Welcome back to Carlisle Day. One of the most joyous elements of reading Carlisle is his language, and especially his rogues gallery of caricatures and grotesques on whom his rhetoric routinely rails. Many of the phrases we use today to describe the mundane trappings of bureaucracy, such as red tape, for example, originated with Carlisle. He loved to coin a phrase and returns to his slogans time and again, almost like layered in-jokes which build up over time. Now, in his own time, this was called Carlisleese. It's also known as Carlisleisms. He was a master of rhetoric. And in this video, I want to give you a flavour of some of his terminology by providing an A to Z of such names and phrases. However, this is not exhaustive, since Carlisle's lexicon is massive. So let's make a start. First up, we have Bobus Higgins of Houndsditch, sausage maker on the great scale. The living embodiment of democracy and laissez-faire economics at their worst. His worldview is entirely materialistic and utilitarian. He will not choose a wise or strong leader, but a Bobismus, which is to say a version of himself. Bobus appears in both past and present and in latter-day pamphlets. In addition to holding the worst political views, Bobus produces shoddy goods. He masks fat bacon with cunningly devised grey pepper spice and fills his sausages with horse meat. Next we have Buckskin, the Honourable Hickory Buckskin, an American Carolina senator, obviously imaginary, mentioned in the occasional discourse, who had dreams of an American slave-owning empire in the Caribbean. The speaker of the discourse warns him that his newly constituted slavery will succeed only if it is fair, just, and according to the fact. Fair, I say, not in the sight of New England platforms, but of God Almighty, the maker of both Negroes and you. Next, we have the captains of industry, a phrase that you'll still see used today in some publications. Carlisle first uses this famous phrase in his essay Count Cagliostro in 1833, where he laments that the leaders of businesses and commerce, ascendant in the 19th century, have degenerated more and more into captains of idleness, leaving a growing population of unprofessionals, lackalls, and social nondescripts. He uses it most extensively in past and present. Next, we have cash payment. In both Chartism and past and present, Carlisle argues that the reduction of social relations exclusively to terms of wages and monetary wealth has a corrosive moral effect. It is a product of both the decline in faith and of economic liberalism. In Chartism, he laments the fact that it has become the universal soul nexus of man to man. In past and present, he contrasts this with the social bonds based on mutual obligation and duty of the feudal era. He also defends this conception in the occasional discourse. Next, we have cheap and nasty. This is Carlisle's name for the shoddy goods produced by British manufacture. Next, we have the dilettantes. This was Carlisle's name for the idle aristocrats who he claimed subscribed to the gospel of dilettantism and formed an unworking aristocracy who consisted in impotent, insolent, do-nothingism in practice and say-nothingism in speech. In his view, the dilettante's slavish devotion to fashion and wit was a symptom of a larger social sickness. Blindness to the truth and the worship of appearance, in other words, a lack of transcendent values. While the greedy middle-class entrepreneurs, like Bobus Higgins, follow the gospel of mammonism, the old aristocracy were essentially asleep at the wheel, and the response of the working classes to this indifference was Chartism or democracy. Dismal Science. Now, this was Carlyle's name for political economy or economics. He constantly mocks the professors of the dismal science, especially in latter-day pamphlets and the occasional discourse. In his view, a heroic leader of Britain would stand up to the professors to let them know that there is more to life than economics. Now we have the distressed needlewomen in Carlyle's London. There was always around 30,000 distressed needlewomen who cannot sew looking for work. These recur in both the occasional discourse and Shooting Niagara and After. There are also the drudges, known as white Negroes, the ragged beggar sect, and poor slaves. These were the poor Irish, who are contrasted with the fashionable dandies. Another term used by Carlyle was dry as dust, or the Reverend Dr. Jonathan Dry as Dust of York. This is an imaginary antiquarian pedant borrowed from Sir Walter Scott's Ivanhoe, written in 1820, who Carlyle uses as a stand-in for modern historians, and he skewers dry as dust mercilessly. Carlyle stars himself as an anti-dry as dust historian. The dry as dust cannot recognise the heroic or the transcendent in history. Carlyle writes in his introduction to Oliver Cromwell's Letters and Speeches, "Dull pedantry, conceited, idle dilettantism, purient stupidity in what shape soever is darkness and not light. Given a divine heroism, they, the dry as dust, smother it well in human dullness and touch it with the mace of death." Next we have Fiddlestring, or Mr. Hesperus Fiddlestring. This is a fictional philanthropist, an agitator against capital punishment, who is virulently attacked by Carlyle in the latter-day pamphlets as a little spouting wretch whose doctrines appear pleasant but are actually ugly and perilous. Now we have Gathercole, the celebrated Gathercole, who is a Yankee friend of the author in Jesuitism, the last of the latter-day pamphlets. He is a Carlylean prophet who says, "Time does not rest on eternity. The world turns out not to be made of mere eatables and drinkables, of newspaper puffs, gilt carriages, conspicuous flunkies. No, but of something other than these." Now we have gigmanity. For Carlyle, a gig is associated with those who invest their energy entirely in pursuit of the trappings of class, at the expense of dignity, integrity, and good sense. A gig man is one who does whatever they can to keep a gig. In other words, they are slaves to the notion of respectability or polite society. And gigmanity is the entire social class that is built on such gig men. Hebrew old clothes. Now, Froude described Carlyle as having a true Teutonic aversion to Jewish people. In latter-day pamphlets, he says that England needs an exodus from Houndage and to discard old Hebrew clothes. In religion, he calls for the burning of Jew old clothes, which had become, in his view, a poisonous encumbrance in the path of men. He especially deplored money lending, which is what he had in mind mostly when he was talking about these things, and employed many of the stereotypes typical of the era. Then there are the logic spectacles, eyes that can only discern the external nature of things, but not the internal nature of them. The professor of the dismal science often has a pair of these on the end of his nose. McCrowdy is a fictional economist, that is one of Carlyle's whipping boys in latter-day pamphlets, the living embodiment of laissez-faire economics and its moral bankruptcy. In McCrowdy's eyes, the universe is not the living garment of God, but a huge, dull cattle stall and St. Catherine's Wharf, with a few pleasant apartments upstairs for those that can make money. Now, McQuirk, Dr. Phelim McQuirk, is a shady doctor who has disappeared, leaving behind a number of disgruntled creditors, and it was he who transcribed the address given by the unnamed orator of the occasional discourse. Next, we have Mealymouth, Viscount Mealymouth, one of the leadership of Britain in past and present. He is friends with such creatures as Sir Jesper Windbag and the Earl of Windlestraw. One can see in these sorts of naming conventions Carlyle's enormous influence on Charles Dickens. Carlyle is an influence on practically all of Dickens's social novels. Next we have the mites and rights. This is a phrase that Carlyle uses habitually. He means that rights are only rights when they are actually enforced, and that most often in history, physical violence determines who has which rights. He maintained that leaders should be prepared to use force. He also maintained that, as in the French Revolution and in the Chartist movements, that the lower classes, when they were neglected and mistreated by the ruling class, had every right themselves to resort to violence. Morrison's Pill. This is Carlyle's name for dubious cure-all solutions to social ills which were being proposed at the time that he was writing. A play on the notorious placebo drug market that was booming at that time in near total free market conditions. It was an unregulated market. Naturally, Morrison's pills are peddled by quacks. Then there is Mr. Facing Bothways, a notorious charlatan and public leader. Mr. Facing Bothways is someone who holds contradictory views and opinions and attempts to gain favour by agreeing with everyone. He appears to have borrowed this from The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan. Then there is Mumbo Jumbo. This is Carlyle's phrase for what he saw as the empty quasi-religious doctrines worshipped by the public. In the French Revolution, he calls Robespierre's attempts to found a civic religion mumbo jumbo. In Hudson's Statue, one of the latter-day pamphlets, at the erection of a statue to a railway tycoon, he writes, "Your miserable religion, as you call it, is an idolatry of the nature of mumbo jumbo, and I would advise you to discontinue it rather. You are infidels, persons without faith, not believing what is true, but what is untrue. I do not want cheaper cotton, swifter railways. I want what Novalis calls God, freedom, immortality. Will swift railways and sacrifices to George Hudson help me towards that?" Now we have pig philosophy, the name given by Carlyle in his discussion of Jesuitism in latter-day pamphlets, to the widespread philosophy of the time, which regarded the human being as a mere creature of appetite instead of a creature of God endowed with a soul, with no nobler idea of well-being than the gratification of desire. That is his only heaven, and the reverse of it is hell. Pig philosophy is a godless theory of self-gratification. In Carlyle's words, an immeasurable swine's trough in which paradise is seen as unlimited attainability of pig's wash. Next we have Plugston of Undershot. Like Bobus Higgins, sausage maker extraordinaire, Plugston is a fictional entrepreneur who runs a textile factory. He's in the cotton industry. However, he is far worthier and more promising as a captain of industry than Bobus because he has courage and what Carlyle calls hard energy. However, he still worships the cash gospel and needs to understand the true nature of things. Now we have Pusseyisms. Carlyle directed this attack on high church Anglicans within the Church of England. It took its name from Edward Bouvier Pussy, an Oxford professor of Hebrew. In Past and Present, he contrasts ineffectual Pussyisms with the solid faith of the medieval Catholic Church, which had a genuine spiritual content. Now we have quacks, one of Carlyle's favourite words. He uses it to describe the people who proposed false remedies to the social ills of his era. You know, the quacks who peddled the Morrison's pills. He had in mind liberal intellectuals of all sorts, humanitarians, as well as the advocates of the doctrines of the French Revolution. Now we have quashy. This is Carlyle's name for black people from the West Indies. This character reoccurs in latter-day pamphlets, the occasional discourse, and in Shooter Niagara, and it is obviously racist in tone. Carlyle depicts quashies as sitting with their beautiful muzzles up to the ears in pumpkins, imbibing sweet pulps and juices. For whatever reason, Quashy is always depicted as having a fixation with eating pumpkins, but after he is full, he will do no more work. Nonetheless, Carlyle is often affectionate towards Quashy, calling him my pumpkin. He says, "I decidedly like Quashy and find him a pretty kind of man, a swift, supple fellow, a merry-hearted, grinning, dancing, singing, affectionate kind of creature, with a great deal of melody and amenability in his composure. However, he believed that Quashy was naturally idle and needed to be guided and severely reprimanded to be kept in line if necessary." In a passage denouncing democracy, Carlyle insists that believing that any man is equal to another is as absurd as pairing Quashy to Socrates or Shakespeare, Judas Iscariot to Jesus Christ. Now we have the sans potato, the hapless being at the bottom of the food chain. This is a reference to the Irish potato famine, and in Chartism, Carlyle is particularly concerned with the Irish immigrants who were flowing into England at that time after said famine. He says, "The wretchedness of Ireland, slowly but inevitably, has crept over us and become our own wretchedness." Now we have sham or phantasm. Along with quacks, this is another of Carlyle's favourite terms. Most frequently, sham is applied to leaders, sham captains, sham kings, sham nobility. These are leaders who fail to live up to their obligations in steering the ship of state, and they lack heroism of any sort. Sometimes Carlyle uses phantasm captains or phantasm aristocracy to mean the same thing. Now we have shovel hattery, Carlyle's disparaging term for the limitations of contemporary religious observance and the general impotence of the church. He deplored hidebound orthodoxy, but a special target of his opprobrium was the Church of England, who he accused of erecting a wretched, shovel-hatted simulacrum of God, which was worse than no God at all. He blasted shovel-hatted quacks who succeeded Cromwell in the Restoration. They were, in his view, guilty of Pussyisms, lapsing into lazy metaphysical air castles, continents of orthodox cobweb, and heaven for the coward that can keep his shovel hat on. Next we have smell fungus, a name created by Lawrence Sterne for a grumbling traveller and fault finder in general, which Carlyle employed very frequently, especially in Frederick the Great. Now we have stump orator, a glib politician who gives empty speeches with appeal to journalists but are entirely devoid of substance. Where have we seen those before? Now we have swarmery, one of Carlyle's names for democracy, which he especially uses in Shooting Niagara. The gathering of men in swarms. Carlyle blames swarmery for both the American Civil War and the reform movement in Britain. Now we have the universal quagmire. This is the general malaise of England, characterised by atheism, laissez-faire economics, democracy and utilitarianism. Now there is Windbag, Sir Jespish Windbag, a fictional parliamentarian and friend of Viscount Mealymouth and Mr. Facing Both Ways, as well as the Earl of Windlestraw. Windbag is the polar opposite of an heroic leader like Cromwell. Rather than enforce his will, he drifts with the winds of public opinion. And finally, there is Windlestraw, the Earl of Windlestraw, who completes the awful foursome of Mr. Facing Both Ways, Viscount Mealymouth, and Sir Jespish Windbag, who make up the British ruling class. I hope you enjoyed this. There's still a lot to come on Carlisle Day, so stick with us, and I'll see you soon.